Hey, come on in. I really feel like we've reached a place in our culture where religious conversations can seem tense or even taboo. So every week, I invite a different guest to sit down with me to talk about what they believe, what shaped that belief, and why it matters. My name's Tony Vicenda, and this is The Threshold. Hey, everybody. Welcome to The Threshold. This is your host, Tony Vicenda, along with my good buddy, Father Colin Parrish. How's it going today?
Reading about O-stems.
O-stems?
Yeah, second declension. Anyway.
How was school today?
It was good.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, I've been realizing that I get a lot of energy when I actually connect with kids and just individuals, right? And so it's difficult to be going to and fro from the assignments.
Yeah. I enjoyed school today also because I got to go hang out with you a little bit. As you guys may have already surmised, or not, because maybe you didn't hear the last one, we are doing one of our priest versus layman episodes this week, which is basically what we do when we are trying to catch up, get ahead. One of us is going to be in town or out of town or something like that. And I just got back from a 10-day stint moving across the East Coast from Chattanooga, Tennessee for a few days up to Indianapolis. And then Father Parrish is going to be out on vacation next week. So we wanted to go ahead and just kind of hop a week ahead. And so we're just going to be chatting about life, important things, unimportant things, things we agree about, and things we disagree about, most importantly. So, Father Parrish, what do you want to fight about?
I do have a topic.
Okay. What is it you want to chat about?
So I've been going back to this book called Mission of the Redeemer, which is not really a book, but it could be. It's called the Papal Encyclical. It just means a document from the Pope. I have it somewhere in my book of my Hermione's purse of books here.
Was Hermione known for having a purse of books?
No, but she had that purse that like was endless.
Did she?
Yeah. Oh, they all had it?
Yeah.
Really?
Well, I mean, it might have been different to her, but like.
Right now in the background, you are hearing Father Parrish chit chat with my little sister, Julia Vicenda, who's joining us here, along with my wife, in, as Father Parrish has delightfully coined it, the perp, or the big purple room in which we record.
The big perp.
The big perp. So this is John Paul II's papal exhortation on the mission of the Redeemer, which means what?
It's a document concerning concerning, I gotta put all that back in now. Anyway, what does it mean to like live the missionary life, to be a missionary in another country?
Okay.
And I initially went to the text because I was talking to a buddy of mine, and he had said to me, well, hey, like, what? Like, I was talking about just my troubles with acclimating to everything about being a priest. And he goes, why don't you go and like pray, like read through the last section of, you know, Mission of the Redeemer about missionary spirituality, which is awesome section. But as in between smoke breaks, I'd bring it out with me and read parts of it and just kind of at random. Anyway, there was a section here that like really struck me, if only for the fact that it's something that's been said, but I don't think it's necessarily something that's lived. Okay. In the U.S. And it's a paragraph. It basically says missionaries who come from other churches and countries must immerse themselves in the cultural milieu of those to whom they are sent, moving beyond their own cultural limitations. Hence, they must learn the language of the place in which they work, become familiar with the most important expressions of local culture, and discover its values through direct experience. And it goes on from there.
Okay.
So this isn't anything new for a Catholic missionary, but what I was realizing was I had some conversations with some friends, and they had just been coming to realize that where they work, they're like their experience is just going into a different cultural milieu, as it said, when they go to work. Like, it's just a normal, Seattle secular workplace. And so it means that there's a different worldview, or at least different assumptions about, like, what's meaningful in the world, what's important or not, what we're meant for in the secular worldview. And so it's a different culture. So they're realizing, they're making a distinction between, there is a certain kind of culture that I receive from being Catholic, right? Like, as it's communicated through the church, and one that I will find in the world. And I was just thinking about that, I was like, I don't think that a lot of Catholics in the U.S., at least on the left coast, would necessarily see themselves as missionaries, but I think they are.
Yeah.
And I think that there is an unfortunate reticence to really understand the culture, to become familiar with its language and with what it finds important and unimportant, with a sympathetic eye. So that you can see the good and the true and the beautiful, and reject that which you find an obstacle.
See, I don't, this is good, because I don't know that I agree with that.
Okay, go ahead.
I think that is true of some Catholics, but I think there are plenty of Catholics who over-associate with the world, mm-hmm. right? So they don't actually view things through the cultural reality of what the church proposes. And so they don't see themselves as missionaries, because they are completely subsumed by the culture in which they live, and they have no understanding of Catholic culture. So actually, when they go to Mass on Sunday, if they go, or when they participate in the life of the church, if they participate, that they actually, that's the foreign culture to them. That's the one that they don't understand, that they don't like take in. I do agree that for those who are, that what you're saying is true, but I actually don't know that I think that's the majority of Catholics.
Let me put it this way then. I think we might be two ships passing in the night on this one, if only for the fact that I would...
Let me drop anchor for a minute so we can chat.
That sounded so strange. Now he's mooning me. Anyway, what I think is, I actually would totally agree with what you just said. I'm thinking about it from those who I see on a weekly basis.
Okay.
And
so those who are active, those who are participating, they have basically isolated themselves in some sort of bubble.
Yeah.
And just kind of, even as they may go about their business of operating within the world, are not necessarily engaging with the world in the way that we're intended to.
Yeah. But neither the individuals that you're talking about, nor the ones that I'm talking about, neither group sees themselves as missionary. So I would totally agree with you on that, actually, on your end.
So why is that important?
Well, it's important because I think that if I'm going to, I always just find it important to make distinctions. And I wish I remember who in the world said this, but it's like some philosopher or maybe political theorist said, the most blessed place for a human person to be is to know where they actually disagree. And
say it one more time.
The most blessed place for two individuals is to know where they actually disagree.
Okay.
Whereas most people just assume that they know what they disagree about. Which, when you live in the world of assumption, what ends up happening is that not only you don't like investigate your own belief in something or system or God, it could be anything, you don't investigate your own thing. You just assume that you know what you know. And you also don't have a curiosity about the other. And like, that's one of the things that I'm curious, like, for that's important for me, is this curiosity about the other. Like, it doesn't really matter where you come from or who you are. I'm curious about you.
Okay.
And so if you don't have the curiosity, there's no ability to really be a missionary.
Right. I remember talking to somebody a little while ago who may or may not go to our parish about talking about that. We just finished this thing, Alpha Course, right? And, you know, they were like really excited about it. And I was like, so who are you going to invite on the next course? They said, well, I don't know anybody to invite, you know, because the goal is that it's an outreach tool, that you're inviting people into conversation about life's big questions, this non-judgmental space. And I said, what do you mean you don't know anybody? Well, everybody I know is Catholic. And I was like, how is that possible? And they were like, well, I mean, I guess not our mailman, but why would I talk to him? And it's just kind of like, I mean, why wouldn't you talk to your mailman? Like, I mean, like, granted, do I have extensive conversations with our mailman? No, but if you are aware that your mailman exists, if you interact with them regularly, like, why wouldn't you talk to them about it? But just the kind of assumption that everybody who you interact with is Catholic, which our kids had for a long time. I think they just assumed everybody was Catholic, or at least they told us everyone was Catholic, and it was just like statistically improbable that everyone they thought was Catholic was Catholic, but so many people they knew were. Or what a lot of times I think people are saying when they say, well, I just don't know any Catholics, they just are saying, like, I don't care about other people enough to actually know what they are, who they are, what they believe. Mm-hmm. Right.
And then the other thing that kind of comes up with this is, well, look, I found that important because just with, again, like this missionary heart that I have, you know, it's helpful for me to gain vocabulary for my experience and saying, like, you know, is it possible for me to live in a culture that is not Catholic or post-Christian, right? And to experience Christ, like that's the question I think for American Catholics right now. The other question is for myself personally, though, is just, is it possible for me, right? And this is like a journey of experience or a journey of discovery. Is it possible for me or not, Lord, to be in relationship with those who are not Christian and receive rest?
Say more about that.
So, like, I my closest relationships with people happen to be with Catholics because they understand the relationship with God that I have to some degree, right? Or at least I'm able to talk with them about the things that really deeply matter. So I'm not going to have that with somebody who's like a Confucian, like that same kind of deep relationship or a relationship on that level. But am I still able to experience a beautiful experience of humanity because Christ is in my life with that confusion, and yeah. and there at that point receive some kind of rest?
I guess that's always seems weird to me. Like, I know you feel that way. Like, I don't understand why you feel that way. Like, mm-hmm. your inability to feel like you can be in deep relationship with somebody who has.
I'm also a neurotic bastard.
Yeah, well, I know that too, but I say that like kind of hypocritically. Most of my really close friends, if not Catholic, are Christians. Like, I mean, like, so, I mean, as much as I say that, I don't like live any differently necessarily. I don't necessarily feel like there's any kind of limitation to that. I'm just very deeply mired in church world. But like, I do have friends like Brad, Tim, other guys like that who I
spend Brad, I still want to get like a,
we do.
Get,
we
yeah.
Do.
That, we like that actually, soon. I think the holidays period would be easier to do anyway. Well,
I'll start a message that on Facebook in just a minute.
Actually, please. That would be lovely.
Let's make it happen. I know, Tim, the guy who runs Around the Table, was like, wants to be on the podcast, or was open to being on the podcast.
Nice.
Sometime soon. And so I would love to do just like a meetup up there with Brad and a couple other folks and play some game.
Raj.
And so, but yeah, I mean, I have friends who are not, but I also, so I guess I don't understand that. I have a hard time when people want to make that, like, if somebody else is going to make my Catholicity an obstacle to our intimacy with each other, I think I would take offense to that. And so I guess I probably feel the same way about you feeling that way about other people. It's not directed at me, so the level of offense is super low, because we're talking about an abstract individual who doesn't actually concretely exist in this moment. But I don't get that. But it's okay. It doesn't mean you need to change how you feel, but I just don't understand why that would be a limiting factor.
No, I mean, and that's the thing. It's like, there's going to be a limiting factor in some regard. I'm not going to be able to share a part of my life that's massively important in a way that, like, where I can share it with you, right, on this level.
Right.
However, right, that doesn't mean that I can't have a profound experience of relationship with somebody. I'm still a human. And Christ proposes the fact that if I have a relationship with him, I become more human.
Right. But let me say this. So if we spend a lot of time on the podcast trying to name the good, true, and beautiful things we see, regardless of somebody's spiritual background. But if we really believe that those transcendentals, this is a little bit like how the sausage is made. So if you don't want to know that, like, move, like, you know, take your
earbuds. There's a YouTube video for that.
Yeah. So if you if we really believe that the good, the true, and the beautiful are transcendental expressions of who our God is, and we believe that we are able to look at other people's life experience and religious experience and draw those things out of them. Then why would you feel like you can't share the good and true and beautiful things that you're experiencing, which, if they're godly, should be all of what you want to share with them, with other people, and have that resonate with them?
I think that there's, so this is helpful. This is getting to the part of the crux of the issue for me, is that I think that I've had enough relationships where that has been explicitly shut down on one hand, a couple. Right. That are wounding enough for me to want to shut down intuitively at that point in the future, where I don't want to share those things because I don't want to get continually shut down on these deeper levels. I think the other part is that, you know, I just meet a lot of people that don't have a vocabulary for experience. Right. Yeah. Like, as opposed, like, and then if I'm thinking about it, like, my reaction to, like, the idea of getting, like, playing a game with Brad and getting this beer, right, is like a good reaction. Like, he's somebody who has words for his experience.
Right.
And so, and I can have that kind of beautiful experience with him.
So is it really, is it really about the religious barrier, or is it about
a human one?
Yeah. Like, is it about the language of experience that you're looking for? Is it about the ability of that person to articulate?
I think it might be about the language of experience issue.
Okay. Because I would actually say, from what I know about you and even about myself, you and I experience that struggle with people who can't talk about it, like who can't talk about, or who aren't even aware that they can't talk about it. So whether they're Catholic or whether they're atheist or whether they're Hindu or whether they're Buddhist, if they're a Catholic who's unable to express, here's why this is significant to me, and here's how I've encountered Christ, or here's how my faith has grown, or whatever, then that's actually what tends to shut down the conversation, right? Like, when you're like, here is my deepest self, or here's a deep part of myself, and I offer it to you, and they're just kind of like, that's nice.
Yeah. See, like, that, okay, that's getting to the crux of the issue. Like, when I just have somebody unable to receive something from me, that's painful, as it would be for them, you know, and like, that's part of the reason why I want to be participating in this podcast, is to, like, learn more and more, like, how to receive the good and true lovely things that have happened in these individuals' life, and to say that's, you know, just to receive it, is something that I at least want to give to other people that I myself don't necessarily receive.
Yeah.
From a ton of people, but I, right. I mean, I've received it enough from my friends, but
right.
On another note, there is another topic that I wanted to bring up.
I want to talk about also too. So let me do mine and then I'll come back to yours. Well, say yours now so we don't forget it.
It's about freedom.
Okay. Let's come back to freedom being another word for nothing left to lose in just a little while. Here's what I want to talk about. So I was at the National Catholic Youth Conference this last week. There, it's a gathering of about 20,000 Catholic young people and about 3,500 to 5,000 adults who just accompany them on that journey. We fill up half of the Lucas Oil Stadium in Indianapolis. There's this huge convention. I did workshops, got to hang out with a lot of my friends. I got to get, we shared a house with these guys from this awesome band called Popple, Kyle Hyman and Dan Harms. Kyle also has a radio show that gets turned into a podcast, The Kyle Hyman Show. Please check it out. Dan is just amazing and works over in Richmond. And we were watching the main stage sessions. We were streaming them to our house because it's more comfortable than sitting in a stadium. And it was right across the street. And so we're just kind of watching, and everything that they do almost, as far as liturgy, prayer, and everything else, is done bilingually. All right. So it's in English and in Spanish, because those are the two primary languages of the American Catholic Church. And the conversation came up about whether that's appropriate, whether that actually impacts the life of young people, why we're doing everything bilingually, and the fact that a lot of people just don't like that. All right. It's not the first time this conversation has come up in the last few years in the group that helps put on this conference that I'm a member of as part of an organization. Right. And there's been a lot of things that have been done with one of the organizations to specifically embrace the Hispanic reality of the American Catholic Church. The fact that currently about 40% of American Catholics are Hispanic, and that within about a decade, it'll be about 60%. So that no longer are we a white American church, right? And so everything is being done bilingually, and that's hard for a lot of people, especially white people. And I talked to a lot of people about it, got their different perspectives, but the really interesting part of the conversation for me is this. People will complain about the fact that not everybody knows what's being said when it's in Spanish, or that it's not done well, or any other number of things. But my thing is this: nobody blinks an eye when we use Latin, mm-hmm. but nobody understands Latin, and it's often not done well. And so I want to talk about your thoughts on why Latin is important to the church, because I've never heard a good conversation about why we care so much about a dead language that, though it's historically significant, really was about the Roman government co-opting the faith to a large degree that then became the institutional reality of our church, and that people treat it almost superstitiously nowadays. So with all that context, the question is this: why do people treat Latin like it has some sort of magic power in the Catholic Church?
Well, I can take a stab at this.
I just want your thoughts.
There's a lot of ink spilled over this issue. I want to maybe like suss out two different topics with that. One is that there is this legitimate, well, they're both legitimate issues. One of the issues that you're speaking to is, what is it with, there seems to be, right, still a negative reception of, to put it lightly, a different cultural reality in the church, right? Namely, Hispanic cultural reality. Up and against, you know, the Irish, German, white mix of right. Catholic experience.
Right.
So there's that. The other one is, how is it that Latin is any different of an issue? Or that's not quite what the question is. It's more of, how is it that we can all be okay with Latin and not be okay with Spanish?
Correct.
So why is Latin different is might be the easier one for me to answer quickly, and then I'd like to hop over to the Spanish question receiving a different culture. So in anything in the faith, there's going to be inconsistencies in this argument, because I'm just doing it off the top of my head, but Jesus gave us symbols right? He had us work with cultural symbols that were appropriated from Palestinian Jewish first century custom.
I mean, he wasn't appropriating them. He was just using them because he was a first century Palestinian Jew.
Yes. But nonetheless, he used them.
Right.
Right. And so, and like those became definitive. So, for example, bread and wine.
Right.
Bread and wine have no meaning to make it kind of pertinent. 16th century Aztec villager.
Okay.
For example.
I agree.
So he appropriated, or he used those things because he was one, and he made them definitive upon us. That being said, there are things that have happened within the history of the body of Christ, within the house of God, that while they may have been incidental in nature, right, just by happening, just by existing, they have become definitive for us in some way, shape, or form. So, for example, liturgical vestments are particularly Roman and Greco-Roman thing.
Right. You're talking about the stoles, the chasubles, like the robes that a priest wears.
Yeah. I mean, these are just the chasuble, which is the outer garment that's usually heavily embroidered, was really just a traveling poncho.
Right.
So, or we think of my Roman collar, which is much newer and doesn't hold any weight of an argument, but it's just to illustrate a point. The white collar was, basically a shirt that would come up and cover over part of the long frock of your university frock, right? You know, it just helps keep the sweat stains off of your more expensive wool frock. Anyway, so, but that became symbolic of something.
Right.
So we have these things that are maybe incidental, but impractical, but they become symbolic and in some way necessary for an identity. So at a certain point, right, now you can think like, well, is mass going to happen without a chasuble? Oh yeah. Mass can happen without a chasuble.
Right.
But there are these things that, while they are at a lower order than what the Savior has given us as far as symbols to use, they are nonetheless taken with a greater weight because they come from a universality of the universal experience of the church that has a long historical pedigree. Now, that being said, you're like, well, what the hell?
But right now, basically what you're saying is like, it's important because it's old.
No, it's important because the experience of the church over centuries, right, has affirmed the use of this, right? And that's not the same thing as just saying it's good because it's old. Because if you're taking that view, all you're saying is that this is all just historical stuff that happened to be that way, whereas the church has appropriated things and she has the ability to say something's definitive or not, right? Because of the fact that she has a role she plays in salvation.
Okay.
So that being said, though, like going back to the Spanish part, I still think I think that your argument holds in other ways where, or your concern holds in other ways where, like, you know, what the hell? Like, we don't know, on just a very human level, we don't understand Latin yet, you know, and we don't understand Spanish yet. We accept Latin and not Spanish. I think there's a lot of stuff in that, meaning, well, like,
let's clarify in the room, theoretically. I mean, let's just, to keep math easy and without trying to, you know, too much guesswork of the people in the room, 0.00005% may understand Latin, 40% understand Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's my big thing. Like, when people were like, no one understands it. Well, but they do. Like, I mean, mm-hmm. they do understand Spanish. Well, that may not be the primary language in which they speak, but that's just as an FYI. Like, that's part of my...
No, totally. And the practical consideration is absolutely necessary to take into account. Let me just say this about that. You know, the official language of the church, what she prefers to be used in the liturgy is Latin. And I cannot get around that. That is just, that's a definitive statement of the church.
Right. No, I get that.
Wait. I'm not finished. Right, okay, I don't want to leave it there either. And part of the, there's a practical thing that I see in that is simply the fact that it is a dead language and that it doesn't change. Right. Whereas I will look at some of these, you know, children of immigrants, children's children of immigrants, they're not, probably not, the vast majority probably will not maintain their language, mm-hmm. their Spanish language. They're going to transition to English.
Right.
Or maybe some catastrophe happens in the United States and we start speaking some other language or whatever. Right. But anyway, I'll leave that to the man in the high castle.
Right.
So I think that there can be an argument for saying Latin is just, you know, it's something that's not going to change. Whereas these folk are going to switch languages, you know, within a generation or two. So that's fine. Great. But I don't know. I'm not necessarily sold on that. I also don't really have a horse in this race. Right. I think that honestly is the last thing I'll say about it. And I'm done, is just like, when it comes to Spanish, like in a circumstance, you know, if I have a significant majority of, you know, population of people here who are speaking a certain language, no one's asking you to say that this other language, this other contemporary language, is more definitive for you than your own. Right. No one's saying that. We're just saying it's the majority, and that's important, and that we have to take that into account, and we have to live that way.
Yeah.
I think it's important to just simply live that.
Yeah. Let me clarify. I have zero problem with using Latin at liturgy. Mm-hmm. I also have zero problem with using Spanish at liturgy. I also have zero problem with using Korean at liturgy or Tagalog, or I don't. If it's culturally representative, to a significant degree, what's the significant degree? I don't know. Does one person in the audience make me think we need to do it? No. Does 5%? Not really. Probably around 20%, I think it starts to become like, hey, not only do I see people who look like me in the faith, but do I hear my culture being represented? And I think language is one of the primary ways to do that. I think for me, the tension kind of becomes between people who are like, well, Latin's the ancient language of the church, and so it's okay to use it even though nobody knows what it is because it's magic, right? It's kind of always the argument, which is not the argument you just made, mm-hmm. in any way, shape, or form. I really appreciated what you said. But then the context is, but we should never use Spanish or another language because some people don't understand it. And for me, it's almost putting the tension of like, look, if we're here as the ancient church for the Christianization of the world, there's absolutely a role for Latin in the church's world. And there's absolutely a role for Spanish and every other language in the church's world, regardless of if everybody in the room speaks English or not, because it actually speaks to a very clear reality, both of them, of the universality of the church, right? Mm-hmm. Like the historic universality of the church, as well as the emergent and continual universal nature of the church. And I guess it really frustrates me when I hear things like, I don't understand that language, I don't whatever, but the same people would just be fine with Latin, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's Latin. No,
it's frustrating. It is frustrating. And I think like, honestly, at the end of the day, we all have to recognize that our faith has been communicated to us in a culture.
Right.
And in as much as it's a human culture, it is going to be able to convey truth and also falsity. Right. There's really nothing that is going to safeguard the white, Irish, Germanic culture, or expression of culture in the Catholic Church in the United States, from conveying truth absolutely. Right. Like, I don't think it can do that. It's a culture. It's a human culture.
Right.
Furthermore, I think that there's actually a lot of problems with that that have come from it. Right. That being said, also, the reason I say that is because it's kind of a plague on both your houses argument that I want to give. It's at the end of the day. Right. the Hispanic culture is going to convey very true things of the faith, right? Or it's going to emphasize very beautiful and true things. But it'll also be like any other human culture, where it will convey errors and distortions that are going to be harmful to people.
Right.
Just as it did with the Irish and the Germans.
Right. Like any other culture.
Like any other culture.
Right.
So at the end of the day...
And even to a certain degree, right, when you should name this, like the Roman culture did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's the thing. Like, so it's not like Latin preserved us or protected us at that point in time.
No, just ask any Greek Orthodox guy. Anyway, yeah. So my thing is like, I may be a little bit more Machiavellian in this, if it's culturally expedient, right? If it's expedient to proclaim Christ, it's going to convey a real value that's going to be helpful for people have an encounter with Christ. Or, you know, let's just do Spanish. I don't want to personally, because I don't know Spanish, and it takes me a lot to learn a language, and it's hard, and I would get pissed off. I would, but it's okay.
Right. Like, I think
it's okay. It's
I think fine. Where we kind of landed at the end was it's really not about the Spanish issue. It's about everything needing to be done bilingually. And to me, when I hear a lot of things done bilingually, I hear them done poorly and in half measure. And so I can get behind the fact of like, I would rather hear something really good in Spanish, even if I don't understand it. And then something really good in English, and then something really good in Latin or whatever. But I just would pursue excellence in whatever it is.
Can I name some prejudice on my part?
Yeah.
Ooh, yeah. Let me name some prejudice. So, okay. Thought experiment for Father Parrish, right? Father Parrish, if you heard Spanish coming from, I don't know, the Mozarabic rite in Toledo, Spain, right? Or you heard some Spanish coming from Mexico, from Puebla, city of Puebla, in a liturgy there, which one would you prefer? And Father Parrish would say, I would prefer the Mozarabic rite in Toledo. Right? Might be a little bit of prejudice. Anyway.
Right.
So just want to acknowledge that.
Right. So tell me about freedom.
Okay, freedom. So I've been going through, so I'm in the movement Communion and Liberation.
How did your guys' thing go? Your big special event gathering?
Oh, beginning day?
Yeah.
It went good, actually. I was happy with it. I was surprised. It was the first day that I
felt. Nothing sounds more cultish about anything I've ever heard about CL than the fact that you guys have something called Beginning Day, by the way.
Well, it's okay. So the reason for Beginning Day is the fact that basically, it's supposed to correspond with the start of the school year.
Right.
So when you start classes again, or when you start, you know, one church again, it's like the beginning, right? So there's a special thing for this, like a special way of like kicking it off of like, how do we attune ourselves to this? So anyway, that being said, because it's an Italian movement, we still have not convinced anybody to have this be done. Well, not because it's Italian. It's just, let me just say it, it's because most of the people that are in the movement are Italian in Italy, right? All the texts that come out for it happen to come out in October, which
when
is
they're
starting classes. Right. But we follow the stupid Germanic system, and so we start classes like in late August or early September when everything is still nice and we just want to punish our children.
Right. Okay, so you guys had Beginning Day. It went well. Because we're reading a book,
mm-hmm.
or a new book.
Yeah, we are reading this book called Disarming Beauty, and which is a series of reflections on faith in the contemporary culture in the Western world. Like, what does it mean to be Christian in the contemporary world right now? What are the real challenges? So anyway, there is this essay on that the leader of the movement, Father Julian Caron, who's a Spaniard, wrote about freedom. Right, what is true freedom? And anyway, it's just it was really beautiful to me to be reminded of this again, because I do think of this as an American or just maybe just a Westerner. But this is the reality that, like, to account for my freedom simply on the level of just the ability to choose one thing or another is not enough. Like that doesn't really fully describe freedom. Okay. nor does the freedom from bonds, like from being responsible for things or being free of things or commitments or responsibilities, neither that also doesn't fully describe the experience of freedom either.
Yeah, so freedom is more than just choice,
and
freedom is more than just a lack of oppression or being tied down.
Yeah. So, the feeling of being free from tied down is a misappropriated emotion, right? It's a true emotion that you experience, but not for that reason.
Okay.
So freedom, for example, freedom, we all have the experience of where when we experience true freedom is like when we have our desire satisfied, right? Where our heart feels satisfied finally, right? In that one moment or in that one circumstance. And we feel this free, like this freedom, this lightness, this lack of constraint almost because we've been satisfied, right? However, what the experience of the Christian ends up saying, or experience of Christ or of his church says, is that freedom is only found in a relationship and in being dependent upon someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so a true freedom. So freedom has a destination. Freedom is about having a perfected heart or a fulfilled heart. That's what freedom is, versus like just the normal American kind of understanding of freedom from bonds or freedom to choose. Right. No, it's like there's something way different and something more. Right. Like my freedom actually has a destination point. My freedom is meant to indicate to me that it's meant for something, someone. Does that make sense?
No, it does. Like, so I was really always kind of enamored by the idea that the place a monk lives is called a cell.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it is this very austere, simple, fairly prison like room, right? That is the place where they sleep and the place where they dwell when they're not living in community, when they're looking for. And the freedom that is gained by kind of surrendering a lot of those things, right? Like we oftentimes think about how, lots of people I think who've never experienced monastic life think about how restrictive it must be or how tied down they must be or how much it must be so hard to have so many obligations or not be able to have the things you want or other things like that, which are kind of assuming a whole lot about mm-hmm. monks. Like it's assuming that they don't have what they want, and it's assuming that they don't have like all these other things that we think of, some of which we named, which are not actually freedom. Rather than thinking about the fact that they are not tied down and restricted by so much of what distracts us from what is truly important, and that they enter more deeply into freedom by the shedding of these things that we commonly associate with freedom. So
yes.
By the getting rid of material goods, by the taking on of a communal life, by the entering into relationships with each other and with Christ, by the eschewing of even the question of what will I wear today, right? Or what will I eat, or any of these other things that we are plagued by continually that kind of they've given all that up and entered into this very freeing space. It totally makes sense to me.
And it's like, he had a phrase, it's called, we're freed from the dictatorship of desires, which is a reduction of desire to anything within reach. And, but he says earlier from that, he's like, how is it that I can verify that my freedom has a destination, right? Mm-hmm. How is it that I can verify within my experience? And he says that if freedom is the experience of satisfaction, of genuine satisfaction that we experience in relationship with people and things, we can do what we like, but we cannot escape this verification. How many times a day do we have a real experience of freedom? That is fullness, satisfaction in the minutiae, in the contingency of everyday choices, in choosing goods and partial attractions. What usually prevails is a feeling of being stifled. You feel trapped everywhere, just waiting to escape. And so he's saying that basically, like in experience, what we find is that even if we attain this kind of like, just we always, you know, scratch that itch, we still go to work and we still feel this stifledness, right? We still feel this lack of freedom. And like the problem is never really solved, versus like the experience of a Christian, of someone who's been changed by this relationship in Christ, they begin to see like freedom, the fulfillment of their heart, even within like the minutiae of everyday life.
Yeah.
And like, there's that possibility where like, holy crap, like, you know, and so that's something that's just beautiful for me to be reminded of. By the way, maybe, I don't know, maybe to, you're probably gonna wrap up, at least I do, cause I got to go to bed soon. But, the circling back to that missionary thing that I brought up at the beginning, the reason why it was important to me, was because talking about the demographic that I was talking about, not the one you were, because I'm totally on page with you on that. It's that I feel left alone sometimes, right? Like, why is it that I go in and get the haircut with the gay barber, right? And, or the barber who is gay. And I tell him, you know, I tell him like that I'm a Catholic priest, right? And he's like, I'm like the only Christian that he ever met. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, where the F are my friends? Yeah. Or like, and that's my thing. It's like, you know, like, well, like, we don't want to expose ourselves to this. Like, fine. But at the same time, like, do you see yourself as a missionary? Like, do you see yourself as like, is it possible to see goodness in humanity? Right. Like, can you come out with me and experience something true, good and beautiful with me? You know, and so that this guy isn't, so I'm not left alone, right? But neither is that guy, right? Like, I guess that's just like what my main sentiment was. Like, I don't want to be left alone in this mission.
Yeah, I know. And I guess for me, I think when I think about what I feel like oftentimes keeps people from this sense of mission or becoming an evangelist around their deeply held beliefs. And I think this is true outside of Christianity, but I think most other realities, I don't like that, most other perspectives, that they actually are less hesitant than Christians for some reason, that there's this kind of weird sense that we are obligating them to something, like the person that we're approaching. And so we remain silent about it. Maybe that comes from a place of like thinking this is true.
Say more about that, or just keep going with
like
that.
Rather than thinking, oh, we're bringing them a gift or we're sharing something that's good or true or beautiful with them, we actually feel like we're putting a burden on them. And so we refuse to, because I think a lot of people who are Christians are caught up in this concept of, I wish I would have behaved worse before I decided to become better. They're caught up in this idea of like, I should have done more bad things before Christianity spoiled my fun, like kind of understanding. And so rather than them thinking like, here's a good thing or a true thing or a beautiful thing, here's freedom that I'm bringing you, here's hell, here's life that I'm offering you, here's eternal goodness that they really see themselves as basically spoiling that person's good time. They see themselves as ruining the dinner party. You know, they see themselves in this capacity that is incongruent with a faith that when shared brings and gives life. Maybe that's from them not knowing how to do it. Maybe it's from their own personal preconceived notions about the faith. I don't know what it's from. But I do sense that there is a significant lack of that. And the weirdest part is, so like, we live in what is oftentimes considered one of the most unchurched parts of the country, but historically Seattle has always been like 24% to 42% Catholic. But you would never know it, because there is no, exactly what you're talking about, there's no sense of a missionary reality, or at least there hasn't been since literally the people who lived here were missionaries, right? We've completely lost that core cultural identity, if we ever actually really even achieved it, right? So
I kind of doubt that too.
What?
That we ever achieved that.
No, yeah. When we talk about Seattle being post-Christian, I don't actually know that I buy it. I almost feel like we never really arrived.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, we have things in our major parts of our civic infrastructure that are named after a saint. I think people just think that Cabrini was a really wealthy family that donated a lot of money to the city at some point in time, you know, as opposed to a missionary. Right. Mm-hmm. And so it's very weird to me. And I just, like I said, I don't understand. Though I think some of what you articulated earlier about, or what we talked about with you not, like, you wanting to give and receive in a relationship, I think that's the hard part. I think people oftentimes are not necessarily free enough to just give.
Mm.
Like, to just say, like, I want to offer you this. I want to give you this thing that I know to be good. And if you can't give back to me, that's fine. That's not what it's about. It's about me willingly offering it. And even if it hurts, or even if I, you know, like, I suffer, or even if whatever, like, I'm free in this, and I'm given life in this, and I'm offering you life in this, mm-hmm. because I'm taking this thing, this faith, this belief I have, this goodness, this truth, this beauty, and I'm sharing it with you. And I think that's important. And I think we have a unique ability to speak into that. But I think it requires us to actually believe it ourselves.
Yeah.
And I think very few Christians actually believe that we're free. I think very few Christians actually believe that we have life. I think very few Christians actually believe that what we have is good and true and beautiful. What they feel like is, I don't want to ruin that person's good time, so I probably shouldn't tell them about Christianity. And I don't know how much of that goes back to decades or centuries of deathbed confessions, but I can't imagine it's a small amount, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so,
I just want to, like, my question is a person able to look at me and say, here's a human, like, here's somebody who has life, right? And if they can't, then that's just a damn shame. Mm-hmm. Because I met Christ because I met a real human, right? It, you know, he communicates his presence through a person, through a people.
No, my question is really, like, are we, this we is not abstract, this we is like you and I, are we willing to actually live as those people?
I am about 40% of the time.
Right. And how do we dispose ourselves to enough grace? Like, that's what it comes down to, right? It's not about, we're not going to miraculously, I mean, well, we'll only miraculously get better at it. We're not going to work our way to being better at it, though we do have to work at it.
Mm-hmm.
How do we get to a point where it's like 60, 80, you know, like 99% of the time? How do we live in this space where we can just be a presence of joy and life and goodness in the lives of other people?
I think it's just, there's a simplicity here about God's relationship with me, where this, it just simply giving in to not seeing him as competitive, to seeing him as fulfilling my humanity, like fulfilling a very human need for me, and giving into that, is the most simple thing. Like, there's a poet, Charles Peguy, who said the most, Paul Coletta, whatever, he wrote a kind of a crappy play, actually, but it was a beautiful play in itself, called The Satin Slipper. And a character said, the only thing that admits of effort is doing evil, because it's going against your nature. Hmm. Right. So the most effortless thing is to become a saint. And I just kind of remind myself about that quite a bit, and just saying, like, how much effort and energy do I put into resisting relationship?
Hmm. So basically, we got to stop trying so hard and just go out and be.
Yeah.
So I go out and do.
Mm-hmm.
Go out and be.
Yeah.
I really like this. I don't want this to overtake what we do. We're still looking for good non-Catholic, non-Christian voices. I really loved our conversation with Eli. It really did push us exactly where I wanted to go. I know we got some good conversations coming up with somebody who used to be Catholic, is now a Buddhist. I'm actually going to talk to one of my previous youths who I got to hang out with this last week, and ask if they'll be on the podcast. They now consider themselves agnostic atheists. I'm not entirely sure. I'm just really excited about the conversations we're getting to have. So for all of our listener friends out there, thank you guys for your support, for your encouragement. I know that we've got a couple of messages on the Facebook page, which is Threshold, facebook.com/thethresholdpodcast, that I need to respond to, that came out last week when I was out of town. Some really good questions about people who are encountering their faith more deeply through Judaism, even though they're Catholics. Some other things like that, just some really good big questions that I want to chew on a little bit more. If you've got a message out there, please be patient with us, or feel free to drop us an email anytime at thresholdpodcast.fm or on the Facebook page, or just, you know, seek us out in real life, buy us a cup of coffee or a beer, and let's sit down and chat. So until next time, get out there, FNF ability, and talk about what really matters. Thank you.